wanting to be in my life would either have to accept my relationship with Wayne or be shown the door. I was never going to leave him again. Days later, I received a phone call from Aaron. "I heard you got married," he said in his deep, growling voice. I was stunned. "How'd you hear that? I haven't told anyone." "I got a call from my barber."
Oh.
Chapter 19. End again. Upon hearing of my recent nuptials, Aaron stayed away and I was happy about that. I was determined to have my relationships by my rules and to never again be and feel as helpless and broken as I was in my first marriage. I assured Nigel there would be no second chances for him in our arrangement. To put it plainly, I was done taking people's shit. Other than Wayne, a man would either do what I said or be shown the door. I was no longer interested in being under anyone's tyrannical rule. I was growing stronger by the day, and while I knew I would have a long road back to recovery, I also knew I had to start somewhere. I had to go into my new relationships with my eyes wide open and my guard up. Under no circumstances was I to fall in love with the man I would meet or the ideals they would try to sell me. I was struggling to regain my footing, and I was in no way interested in having a man come into my life distracting me from the pressing matters at hand. I was in charge, and I was focused. However, I was still trying to dig myself out of a financial hole, and my career had long stalled, even though my fourth book, Satisfaction, Erotic Fantasies for the Advanced and Adventurous Couple, had just been published. There were no new deals in sight, and I wasn't even sure of the direction in which I wanted my career to go. I knew I wanted to create something bigger, something I cared about, and not just what publishers or readers wanted from me. I wanted to do something meaningful, but struggled with what that would be. I straddled the fence between wanting to reveal what my life was really like and continuing to publicly perpetuate the kind of life the public thought I was living. I wanted to show the world who I really was and what my home life was really like, including the adoration of a husband who was so grateful to be married to me. He did everything I asked, all day, every day. He was subservient, and I loved it. He did most of the cooking and cleaning and chauffeured me around. Every morning and evening after my showers, I'd lay naked on the bed while he massaged my entire body with lotions and oils. Nigel was devoted to his new position, but apparently my husband didn't take me seriously when I told him what I expected of him. Just a little over 1 month after we were wed, my arrangement with Nigel was already over. The only stipulations I'd given him were that he was to do whatever I told him and under no circumstances was he to ever break my trust. Just days after our wedding, he flew to Jamaica to spend a month with his son, a flight for which I paid. While he was there, I sent him money for food and bills since the man hadn't a dollar to his name. I upheld my part of the deal and took care of Nigel and his son, expecting him to remain honest. Still, my intuition told me he wasn't, though it wouldn't be until Nigel returned home in November that I would catch him in a series of lies. Just a few days after his return, I'd put Nigel to work rebuilding the master bedroom closet. My apartment was small, and my bedroom seemed to be built for just one person. So while Nigel was away, I'd measured and planned how to maximize the space for us both. Then, with the plans I made, we visited IKEA and the Home Depot for supplies. Nigel was a hard-working man who had all sorts of skills. He could rebuild car engines and had worked in construction back in Jamaica. He looked forward to the task of rebuilding the closet, and I was happy to help however I could. But while Nigel worked, I noticed he was continuously receiving text messages and responding to them. Every minute or two, his phone would chime, and he would promptly return the text before returning to his work in the closet. My suspicions and sixth sense couldn't take it anymore. I needed to know what and who was in that phone. "I'll be right back," I said as I picked up his phone. "I'm going to the bathroom with your phone, and I think you know why." Nigel looked up at me from the floor of the closet, stunned and afraid. "Okay," he said nervously. I walked calmly into the bathroom and locked the door behind me. Seconds later, Nigel stood on the other side of the door. "Babe," he said. "Babe." I stood there silently as I rummaged through his phone. As I suspected, the recent rash of text messages he received were from a woman he was with while in Jamaica. I fumed. Upon further snooping, I found a slew of text messages from over 20 women all over the world, all of them inappropriate. Then I found the most disturbing set of messages of them all. While away, he had been chatting with and wooing a woman who lived next door to Rohan, trying to persuade her to join him on the island. After skimming through his phone further, I found messages between them in which he was trying to convince her to be with him here in the United States and evidence of his visiting her apartment just days after his return home. As irritated as I was to be footing the bill for this loser, only for him to do the one thing I'd asked him not to, I was more tickled by the fact that someone so broke, so black, so short, so ugly, and so stupid could have over 20 women on his phone at one time. I was fucking floored. I warned my husband before we were married that there would be no second chances for him. I warned him that if he broke my trust, if I found him to be a liar, a sneak, a cheat, or a fraud, that it would be the end of our little arrangement. I said it, and I meant it. It was just days before Thanksgiving when I found out about my husband's trysts and infidelities, so immediately upon my discovery, I demanded Nigel pack his shit and leave. He cried like a baby, and even got on his knees and begged for my forgiveness. He must have pleaded, even as he packed, for 2 hours, but I didn't care. I tried to deliver him back to Rohan, and even Rohan's brother, Chris, who also lived in the complex, but they refused him. Nobody wanted Nigel. So there I was, stuck with a husband I didn't want, who had nowhere else to go at a time of the year when everyone he knew was out of town with their families. Begrudgingly, I let him stay with me through the holiday season and into the new year. Nigel and I celebrated the holidays as a fake family and continued about our daily lives as if everything wasn't completely ruined. He continued taking care of the household chores while I continued supporting him. He overcompensated for his mistakes and tried too hard to make our arrangement into a real relationship. He knew he was on thin ice, and with his citizenship hanging in the balance, he was trying everything he knew to be the perfect husband and houseboy, but it was too late. Naturally, I continued to see Wayne. He always had a special ringtone in my phone, which rang even if my ringer was turned off. It was always one of his songs, and I made sure the volume of the ringtone was at its highest, accompanied by vibration. There was no way I would miss any of his calls or text messages. He had complete and total access to me any and every time of the day and night. The calls and texts would come at random times because of the somewhat random hours of his professional and personal schedule. I'd leave the house early in the morning to see Wayne and tell Nigel I was headed to a breakfast meeting or go over to Wayne's hotel in the middle of the afternoon, claiming to be running errands. I just didn't feel the need to explain to Nigel where I was going, when I'd be back, or with whom I was spending my time. Our marriage was a sham of an arrangement, and he had already proven he could not be trusted. I was just biding my time until I got rid of him. I felt more in charge of my life than I'd felt in years, and the truth of the matter was that I took on a persona very reminiscent of Aaron's. I did what I wanted, when I wanted, with no conscience or worries of repercussions. I was free of the chains that had bound me for so long, and there was nothing that could keep me from my happiness. I was determined to have what and who I wanted, when I wanted. I felt as if I had earned the right to run my life and do whatever I pleased, no matter what. After the holiday season, I stuck to my guns and let Nigel know he was still expected to move out. His cousins were back from their vacations abroad, but still neither Rohan nor his brother Chris wanted anything to do with Nigel. So in January, he packed up and went to live with a friend he knew from Jamaica who lived deep on the outskirts of the San Fernando Valley, about 55 minutes away from me. I was ecstatic. It didn't take long after cutting ties with Nigel to realize that my newly rediscovered ability to run my life and the power that came from that feeling had overtaken my good sense and judgment when it came to my plan for marriage. I'd been drunk with it, still trying to prove something. I felt the need to show that my divorce from Aaron wasn't my fault, that I was lovable and capable of getting someone else to marry me despite Aaron's insistence I never would. Even though I was resigned to the fact that I would never be normal, I still, even now, wanted at least to appear normal. But I shook that notion almost immediately after it came. I didn't need a marriage to validate me publicly or otherwise. Since putting Nigel out of the apartment, he found it difficult to stay away. He had become so accustomed to being home with me and doing things for me, it seemed as if he didn't know who he was or what to do without me. I understood that feeling. Still, he soon grew into a needy nuisance. He begged to come by at least once a week, sometimes two, to watch our favorite television shows. He wanted to keep in touch with Naeem, who, at this point, didn't care who came and went out of our lives. He was over it, just as I was. I was trying to wean Nigel from my bosom and began revoking his visitation privileges, little by little, until I'd had enough and cut him off altogether. He needed to begin his own routines and traditions and to break away from the ones we'd form during his stay with me. And I needed to stop giving him pity sex. I had to put an end to everything. So, in March 2012, after a few weeks apart, I called Nigel over and, jovially, he met me at my apartment with hope in his eyes. We sat on the sofa watching our shows, eating dinner, then dessert, drinking wine and being cordial. But I was withdrawn. I waited until our programs were over before reaching underneath one of the sofa's cushions, pulling out a folder, and handing it to him. "What's this?" he asked, with trepidation. "I've had divorce papers drawn up. All you have to do is sign them," I cautiously replied. As Nigel thumbed through the paperwork, his energy changed. He began to panic. Everything was coming to an end for him. I understood that feeling, too. He jumped up from the sofa. "I'm not signing this," he insisted. "That's a joint dissolution. You don't have to sign it, but if we both sign those papers, it'll be over faster and easier. If you don't sign it, I can always do it the other way, which means that I can file on my own, have you served, and no matter what you do, we'll still be divorced in 6 months." Nigel's eyes began to dart as he paced the apartment wildly. He began muttering and tripping over his words. "I'm not signing anything. I need to have an attorney look over this," he insisted, as a way to stall the inevitable. "Attorney? You don't even have a car, and you're talking to me about attorneys? Look, this is a standard form. Look at it. It's easy to comprehend. Read it and just sign it." But Nigel wouldn't go away that easily. He was terrified of losing me completely, knowing his chance of American citizenship was slipping away. But whether we were married or not, I no longer had any intention of helping him gain citizenship, and I had no intention of establishing a life together. He had already shown himself to be untrustworthy, and I was finished. The marriage alone wouldn't guarantee him a green card. The marriage would have to be entered into in good faith, and I would have to pay thousands of dollars, fill out mountains of paperwork, and subject myself to government protocol. He was no longer worth it. We argued for the next 2 hours as Nigel refused to sign the papers and then refused to leave the apartment. He begged me to change my mind and pleaded with me to just sit and talk everything through. He apologized for his mistakes and promised to do better, but I wasn't interested in any of that. Eventually, I had to pretend to call the police to get Nigel to leave without signing the joint dissolution. Several weeks later, I filed another set of divorce papers and had Nigel served. He dragged out the proceedings, and it took over a year for our divorce to become final. In the meantime, Aaron's radar sent off a signal letting him know I was free. It had been 6 months since Nigel and I married, and during that time, Aaron waited in the wings, keeping in contact via email and sporadic phone calls. Soon after Nigel's departure, the calls and emails became more frequent. It was as if he knew I was alone. When I confirmed that Nigel was gone for good, Aaron expected to pop back into my life and take what he felt was his rightful place by my side. He began frequenting my apartment with Jonah again. It was ironic, but the moment I stopped needing to be part of a family, realizing that Naeem and I were family enough, Aaron made himself and Jonah more available to us than he had in prior years, wanting to become members of our family. But it was too late. Though I enjoyed their company and loved being there for Jonah, my heart had moved on. Aaron struggled as he tried to draw me back into his world. He kept looking for signs that I was falling back under his spell, but the signs never came. I didn't need him to love or validate me anymore. But what I did need was financial assistance. There were parts of my life I could never explain to Wayne, Shad, Ant, or anyone else. If I told them I'd lost everything, I'd have to answer the questions that would follow. Questions about Aaron and Nigel. Questions about why I hadn't acquired another book deal since being released from my last contract in 2010, and what I'd been doing with my life and money over the past several years. I couldn't stand the possibility of having to explain the mess my life had become and the bad decisions I made along the way, so I kept my troubles to myself. I never divulged my financial woes to them, just as I never divulged all I'd gone through with Aaron over the years. Therefore, I could never ask for financial help from friends who had the ability to help me. I couldn't bear the shame. Soon, it was summer, and even though I was completely over Aaron, I was still suffering from the decision I made to let him into my life back in 2007. I returned my Range Rover and my Mercedes-Benz E-Class, all to the detriment of my credit, and purchased a used Mercedes C-Class soon after moving into the new apartment. I was struggling to pay my $3,000 rent and my car note, as well as for everyday essentials like groceries and utilities. I lost most everything I'd worked so hard to earn, and now I needed help to maintain the few things I had left. Every little bit helped. My friend Bruce had been doing a good job of assisting me over the past couple years. He and I met back in 2006 and became fast friends. We never dated, but shared intimacies. I saw him as just a friend, as he was never my type. So when he entered into a relationship and got engaged in 2007, I was happy for him and hoped he would forget all about our trysts and focus on being just friends. And he did. Until I needed money. As with most of my friends, Bruce was accustomed to me having my own everything. I had been self-sufficient for the majority of the time we'd known one another, making it easy for me to shrug off his advances. When the circumstances changed and I began needing more and more help, Bruce used the opportunity to make me earn the money I needed. Disgustingly, he turned our friendship from platonic to sex for hire, and I felt like I had no choice but to let him. I was now living mostly off of my bi-yearly residual checks, and even though I was no longer shelling out $20,000 a month in bills, my living expenses, coupled with previous debts related to my marriage to Aaron, were still too much for me to handle. I wasn't sinking as quickly as I was before, but I was sinking nonetheless. By the time I left my home and moved into the apartment in the city, Bruce was sporadically chipping in to help me pay for my basic day-to-day needs between residual checks. As time went on, and more of his money was spent, he began asking for favors like foot rubs or manicures. Over time, the tasks became more demeaning, and after a while, wound up being purely sexual. There wasn't a time after mid-2011 that Bruce gave me money before or without some sort of sexual favor. By the time I wiggled myself free from my legal woes with Aaron, I had dug an even deeper hole with Bruce. Still, he spoke of our arrangement as if it were some sort of functioning relationship. He often mentioned how safe he felt with me and how close we had grown over the years. It was as if we were having two different relationships, because we were. Bruce was happy to have me in his grip, and I was praying to God for a way out. Chapter 20, The Way Out. As my financial troubles mounted, Aaron did his best to help out around the apartment, paying for groceries and small bills, while Bruce mostly took care of my rent during the leaner months. In just 5 years, I had managed to go from a completely self-sufficient woman with a thriving career to an out-of-work author depending on the men in my life to keep me afloat. More than that, I was depending on the two men I loathed the most to stay alive. Bruce had turned our friendship into a financial arrangement, and Aaron hadn't changed in all the years I'd known him. He was still throwing tantrums and trying to affect me with the same games, like disappearing for days or a week at a time. The only difference was that this time, I didn't go chasing after him. When he got jealous about my dealings with Wayne or my ongoing friendship with Shard, he would take off and stay gone, waiting for me to call or text. I wouldn't, and after a week of no contact, he'd return. His old tricks no longer garnered any fanfare or uproar from me. There was no chasing or calling or driving around in the middle of the night searching for him. Those days were over. I was spending most of my time with Wayne and dabbling in dating others. I was single and free of emotional bondage for the first time in years and enjoying it. But I still had no idea what my next professional move would be. I didn't know what my readers wanted from me, and I wasn't able to give publishers the smut they wanted. I'd been through so much since the publication of Confessions of a Video Vixen, and my life was vastly different. Publishers may have thought I was living some sort of high life, running around with one celebrity and the next, but that was all part of the persona. A persona that had taken on a life of its own. I couldn't give them a book about a life I wasn't living. I couldn't give them a book about anything. I was in some sort of purgatory between wellness and sickness, teetering between utter failure and rekindled success. I kept pulling myself out of one ditch only to land in another. By September 2012, I was barely making it, running out of money and time. And then, the bottom fell out. I needed both Aaron and Bruce to help me make ends meet while I taught myself the ins and outs of self-publishing. The industry had changed dramatically over the past 7 years since my entree into it, and I needed to educate myself on all the ways I could make books and money on my own in the event no publisher would ever want to sign me again. So, I focused on researching the information I would need to be a successful self-publisher while also beginning to rebrand myself and my online presence, slowly chipping away at that harmful persona I created. I had a long-term plan. It took several years to dig this ditch, and I needed time and financial help to dig my way out. Aaron didn't have an issue with Bruce. But Bruce had an issue with my relationship with Aaron, unbeknownst to me. So, when Bruce shorted me $800 that month and I couldn't pay the rent, I didn't understand how he could just sit back and watch me get evicted. This is a man who loved to remind me what a true friend he was, even though all the money he handed me was now attached to sex. And even though he had millions of dollars in the bank, he insisted this was all he could do. I didn't fight. I had no fight left. After turning in the keys to my apartment, Naeem and I squeezed into my car, filled with my personal belongings, and checked into an extended stay hotel in the suburb of Woodland Hills on September 11, 2012. I walked away from the apartment and from Aaron after seeing the monster inside him rear its head once again. As he punched a hole in the pantry door, a switch flipped, and all of a sudden, I was just done with him. After all he'd done, after all the trouble, the beatings, the choking, the spitting, the allegations, and after all his efforts to end my life and livelihood, that was it. A fist through the cabinet did it. With the majority of my belongings in storage, Naeem and I settled into the hotel with a few suitcases of clothing and toiletries and a large tote filled with food. Our room couldn't have been more than 600 square feet, with one queen-size bed, a bathroom, a desk, chair, TV, small closet, and a kitchen complete with pots, dishes, utensils, a full-size refrigerator, and stovetop. For the next 2.5 months, my son and I would call this place home. The irony was, my son and I lived in the same hotel before, way back in the year 2000, a time I wrote about in Confessions of a Video Vixen. I was homeless back then too, before there were any books, any Oprah appearances, first-class book tours, and infamy. I was right back where I started. The significance of this wasn't lost on me. As painful as this time in my life was, I knew it was necessary. I knew it would be uncomfortable and I would have to go through the darkest of tunnels before seeing the light. I knew God had something for me, and after all the mistakes I made, after all the lessons I refused to heed, I was ready for my punishment. I couldn't run from it anymore. We settled into the hotel with only enough money for a week's stay, and as much as I hated depending on Bruce and the turn our friendship had taken because of that dependence, he was the only person I had. But the idea of groveling and humbling myself to him after he purposely shorted me on the rent pained me. I was determined to make it without him as long as I could. There were just 3 weeks until my next residual check, and with it, I would be able to move into a new place and start over. So I hunkered down and prepared for whatever lay ahead. There was no way to deny I did this to myself. As I sat on the bed in that tiny hotel room, watching my son sink into the recliner with his laptop, a wave of guilt came over me. I did it to him, too. In my mind, I reviewed all that happened over the past 5 years and wondered where it all started, where it all went wrong. It would have been easy to take it back to when I was a child. I could have blamed it all on the bloody beatings my mother gave me, on the fact that she never hugged me or told me she loved me except once at the urging of a friend. I could have blamed it on my absentee father who, even though he tried to remain in my life when I was a child, hadn't succeeded. Though he did everything he could for me after I was sent to live with him, after I threatened to kill my abusive mother, he had never been a nurturer. I could have blamed my bad decisions on the man who kidnapped and raped me repeatedly for 3 days when I was 13 years old. I could have blamed them on the other man who kidnapped me and held me at gunpoint when I was 16, ordering me to have sex with him before the gun jammed and I fled. My list of childhood and adolescent atrocities goes on, and sure, I could have blamed it on all the horrible things that happened to me in my formative years, when I should have been learning how to become a virtuous woman, but instead was taught about abuse, fear, neglect, and insurmountable pain. Every adult in my life had dumped their shit on me since I was born, and I could easily have blamed my current circumstances on all of them. But I didn't. The event that triggered a domino effect of ill-fated choices and unfortunate events was that kiss. It was the day I let Aaron close enough to touch me. It had taken 5 years for me to break free from his clutches, and still I was under his curse. I knew then that I would never see or speak to Aaron again, just as I knew I would have to work harder than I'd ever worked to get back to where I'd been before I let him into my life. And the work would start there, in that room, on that day. I vowed to keep my focus and find the inspiration to write again. I immersed myself in ideas and research. I was feeling more motivated than I had in years and found a song and music video on YouTube that would fuel my determination. Hold Me Back by Rick Ross. I began devising a plan to get myself out of this particular ditch and never return. I jotted down ideas in a notebook and began making phone calls to executives I'd met along the way. I reconnected with people in powerful positions and fired my attorney and manager to make room for new representation. I needed to be surrounded by people who were excited about me and could see my vision, whatever that vision would be. On my third day in the hotel, I was feeling energized and determined. I was fully focused and looking forward. I knew getting back on my feet would be one of the hardest things I'd ever done in my life, but it wasn't unfamiliar to me. I'd been there before, many times, and I always persevered. This time, however, would be the last. I would make the uphill climb back to the top, and I would never fall again. I promised myself. I fortified my mind and my heart with prayer and leaned heavily on Deneen for daily spiritual guidance and teaching. There was no way I'd make it out of this time and place in my life and into the truest purpose without clarity, humility, patience, and prayer. I had a lot of making up to do, and I was up for the challenge. Then, I met a man. Isn't that always how it goes? 2 weeks before I left my apartment and settled into the hotel, I'd been invited to have dinner with a friend at Boa Steakhouse. In passing, I was introduced to Taj. My friend stopped him to say hello as Taj was rushing toward the door and introduced us. Taj shook my hand, excused himself, and dashed out of the restaurant, leaving his date at the table for over 2 hours. I didn't know anything about this man, but after watching his date sit alone for so long, I gathered he must have been a jerk. I never thought about the encounter or him after that. Why would I? We'd barely said 2 words to each other. But 2 weeks later, as I sat in my extended stay hotel room, combing through Twitter, following people who had recently followed me, I received a private message from Taj, reminding me we'd met 2 weeks prior. I was hesitant to engage. We sent private messages back and forth for the next 4 days as he insisted I meet him for lunch or drinks. Eventually, we exchanged phone numbers and began texting one another before finally talking on the phone. Taj was easy to talk to, and he was funny. More than that, he was smart, and our conversations soon took an artistic and intellectual turn. He intrigued me and was intrigued by me, but there was so much going on in my life that I didn't have time for another man or for much of anything other than erecting myself. Still, I enjoyed his levity during what was an especially trying period of life. After nearly running out of money and time at the hotel, Naeem and I packed our bags and headed to a friend's place, deciding to save my last few $100 for food and water. So, we left Woodland Hills and met my friend Tasha at her apartment on the seedier side of Los Angeles. I was instantly nervous as Naeem and I drove through the dilapidated neighborhood. The places and people we passed looked vastly different from what we were accustomed to. Naeem looked shocked by the conditions. "Don't worry, babe. We won't be here long," I assured him, but I could see the worry in his eyes. "I know it's not what we're used to, but we have nowhere else to go right now. I'll think of something, I promise." Chapter 21, Passion Fruit. Refusing to lean on Bruce for financial assistance, I figured I would try to make it on my own for the next 2 weeks until my residual checks arrived. It was around this time I realized there were very few people in my life I could consider friends. I had a phone book filled with hundreds of names and phone numbers of people I barely knew, and there were only a couple people I could call to ask for a place to stay. So I swallowed my pride and did just that. Meanwhile, as I settled into Tasha's apartment, Taj continued to call and text, asking to meet with me. It was mid-September 2012, and I was staying in the extra room at Tasha's cluttered, unkempt apartment in a dilapidated part of town, a rough neighborhood in which I wouldn't usually find myself. But I was there, led to that place by a chain of events that began over 7 years before, and I couldn't have felt lower. Naeem and I settled in that first night, but by the next morning, I wanted to get him out of there. I didn't want him to be in that part of town or in that apartment one moment more than necessary. So I drove him to our old neighborhood in the suburbs and dropped him off at his best friend's house for a few days. I wanted him to have a slice of normalcy in the middle of all the chaos. I felt guilty for having done this to him, to us, and I wanted to do whatever I could to ease his anxieties or fears. Though he never expressed them to me, though he always seemed to trust me and be okay as long as I appeared okay, I knew he felt what I felt. He was my son, and for the past 14 years, we went through everything together. With Naeem safe, comfortable, and happy at his friend's house in the suburbs, I stopped by the nail shop to have my nails painted. I didn't have much money, but with a string of meetings set over the next week, I wanted to look and feel as best as I could. I didn't want people to look at me and be able to tell something was wrong. All that day, Taj and I spoke on the phone and sent text messages back and forth, and though I had taken a vow to stay focused on the work that needed to be done, I welcomed Taj's distraction from my circumstances. He was sweet and kind when he spoke. I found myself genuinely laughing for the first time in a while. I felt a rush every time my phone chimed with a new message from him or rang when he called. As I was finishing up at the nail salon, we finally made plans to meet for lunch. Suddenly, I had something to look forward to. I liked that feeling. Taj allowed me to pick the restaurant, and I knew just where to take him. There was this little all-you-can-eat Korean barbecue place tucked away in a small, nondescript shopping mall that I simply adored. It was unassuming and cheap, but the food was good. It was a hole in the wall, in stark comparison to the steakhouse where Taj and I first met. I didn't want anything fancy. I arrived first and waited nervously for him to arrive. I wasn't really prepared for a first date. I wore baggy, deconstructed jeans with an oversized tee. My hair wasn't done, and as usual, I wore no makeup. When I left Tasha's place, I'd only expected to drop off Naeem, have my nails painted, then head back to the apartment to figure out my next moves. But Taj insisted we met that afternoon, and I could no longer resist. Once seated, we ordered raw, thinly sliced meats and vegetables to be cooked over the built-in grill at our table, as well as beers and sake. It was a fun first date as we told stories and asked questions. We knew a lot of the same people and found similarities in our experiences. He was just so funny, and my stomach hurt from the belly laughs. We took our time at the restaurant, though we were sweating from the incredible heat coming from the burning grills throughout. This particular hole in the wall didn't come equipped with air conditioning, and with the outdoor temperatures soaring well into the 80s, the restaurant seemed to have peaked to about 100 degrees, and all we could do was laugh. By the end of our lunch, I was smitten. I didn't want to leave Taj, and Taj didn't want to leave me. So we stayed together that day. I parked my car on a side street, hopped into his, and tagged along as he went to the barbershop for a haircut. Then he took me for frozen yogurt. After that, we settled at the Mondrian Hotel for drinks. By then, the sun was soon to set, and as we sat near the pool enjoying the evening breeze, we talked further and more deeply. It was here that I got my first real look at Taj. He was so handsome to me, though not traditionally so. He had this glimmer of hope in his eyes when he talked about art and creation. We connected as we spoke about the power of writing and the importance of words, of visuals, moving and still pictures, and the conveying of emotion through them. It was here that I first discovered I knew his work, the art he made, and in fact, knew it quite well. I'd been tracing his fingerprints for a while now, and through his art, I already loved him. He was the director of Rick Ross's Hold Me Back, the same music video I'd been using to get me through this terrible time. Taj had a passion, a fire that had gone out in me years ago. The way he talked about how his work made him feel made me want to feel that way again. I connected with him on a creative level, not because I was able to feel the way he felt, but because I remembered what that feeling was like. He was a sculptor, a painter, a man who could take a rib from himself, place it in the dirt, breathe into it, and bring me back to life. I was just that inspired by him. Feeling comfortable, I confided in Taj as the sun set over West Hollywood. "I'm in between places," I said. "I have a couple of weeks until I'm able to find a new place, and I'm staying at my girlfriend's apartment in the ghetto somewhere. I hate it there."
"Well, why don't you come stay with me?" Taj suggested, to my delight.
"Really?"
"Yeah, I mean, I'm in the middle of moving, so a lot of my stuff is in storage already, but you're more than welcome to stay for a few days if that'll help you out."
"It would. It really would."
"Okay, so you go get your stuff, and I'll head over to Target. I need to pick up some sheets, blankets, and towels for you."
"Oh my God, thank you so much," I exclaimed as I hugged him tightly. Taj was right on time. I raced back to Tasha's place and grabbed my bags, which I'd never unpacked. I quickly piled everything into my car and sped over to the Target where Taj was still shopping. I didn't want to lose track of him. By the time he was finished buying supplies, I was pulling up to the store and met with him just in time to follow him home. He lived in a beautiful high-rise building downtown overlooking the city. There was very little in the apartment, as he had warned, but there was enough to make me comfortable.
"Sit on the couch and don't get up," he ordered, as he scampered around the apartment cleaning things and making the bed. He was adorable.
Once he finished, I took a long, hot shower and released all my worries and fears for a while. I slipped into a large tee and a pair of black panties, then under the covers as Taj worked in the other room. All the doors in his apartment were made of glass so that, as I lay in bed, I could see him at his desk across the way. I fell asleep watching him, and when I awoke around 4 a.m, I opened my eyes to see him still at his desk, lit only by the glow of his computer. He inspired me. I crept out of bed and tiptoed across the concrete floors and into his office. He looked up at me and smiled, saying nothing. Instinctually, I stood behind him, wrapping my arms around his neck and chest, bending to his neck, kissing it. My hair fell all around him, and he let out a sigh, tilted his head, and closed his eyes. "Come to bed," I whispered. "In a minute." For the next 3 days, Taj and I talked and laughed. He shared his work with me, and I shared my ideas with him. He slept very little and seemed to always be working, because he was. Even when he lay in bed, I could feel him still working. His dreams were vivid, and his body twitched in his sleep as he held on to me, our bodies never apart. On the 4th day, I left to pick up Naeem and bring him back with me to meet Taj. The two of them found a certain connection, a camaraderie, as their demeanors were quite similar. It was as if they were the same person, just decades apart. I loved seeing my son smile and laugh with Taj as they got to know each other. Having the three of us together completed my vision of Taj. I saw him romantically, and I saw his potential as a father. I saw him as a friend and a confidant, a peer and a matcher of wits. And as I watched him work in his office into the night and the early hours of the morning, I saw him as a man with vision. He inspired me every time I awoke from my sleep and found his side of the bed empty.
I remembered a small piece of myself whenever he came in from working on a project all night and drew up plans for a new project by the glow of his computer screen between dusk and dawn. I remembered when I'd had that drive, when I'd worked that hard. I remembered what it was like to be commissioned to start and finish a project by a deadline and to pour my heart and soul into it, hardly sleeping until it was done. For all I'd accomplished before meeting Taj, I wanted to be like Taj and to have what he had. Passion. Of all the things Aaron took from me, of all the things I gave away, my passion for writing was the most greatly missed. It was the basis of my success and self-sufficiency. Writing was how I coped with life. Sharing that life with the world was my way of giving my sorrows, my injustices, and my grievances back to the universe. But now I couldn't write. I would stare at the blank document on my computer, my cursor blinking, begging for the words. I hadn't written a decent page of anything since I finished the Vixen Manual in 2008, before its release in 2009. Even if I'd still had a publishing contract after that, I wouldn't have known what to write. I didn't know what to say. More than not knowing what people wanted from me, I didn't know what I wanted from me. All I knew was that I was in this horrible place in my life, and I'd been living between hell and purgatory for the past 5 years. I knew that if I could write, I could write my way out of this place. But each time I poised my fingers on my keyboard, they stalled. Each time I searched for inspiration, it escaped me. Life was too dark, too sad, and nothing and no one moved me. Until Taj. Naeem and I left Taj's place 5 days after I arrived. It was time for Taj to move out, and while a part of me didn't understand why I couldn't go with him, a part of me knew just why. Our 5-day first date was over. I cried when I left Taj, and I thought about him every day. I longed for him. I longed for the energy he gave me, the spark that ignited between us, the twinkle in his eyes when I marveled at his work and the fire in mine. My body missed his at night, and my resurgent need for a creative outlet called out for his brilliance. Still, I was charged by the time we spent together, and even more determined to get my life back, to find my words and my direction, and to write something, anything. So I continued making phone calls and taking meetings. I hired a new manager and a new attorney, and began thinking of ways to get back to work. But what would I write? What would be the catalyst that would end my writer's block and jumpstart my passion? What could possibly undo the emotional damage and blockages caused by the abuse I'd survived over the past 5 years, the horrible decisions I made, and the hell I'd been through? The answers were approaching. Chapter 22. Proof of life. On September 19, 2012, I received a private message on Facebook from Jillian Bowe, senior editor at Daytime Confidential, asking how Aaron was coping with being let go from his CBS soap opera several weeks prior. It all began to make sense. When Aaron came back around, he didn't know I was having trouble keeping my head above water, but he did know that he wouldn't be continuing his stint on the soap opera and he was looking for me to save him. But I couldn't, not again, not anymore, and he could never save me. So he was content to lie around the apartment, using it as a post in his quest for convenience for as long as he could before we all had to jump ship. Meanwhile, Bruce sat back and waited for the destruction, for me to learn some sort of lesson. I did. After leaving Taj with nowhere to go and hardly any money left, Naeem and I parked in a familiar neighborhood as the sun began to set and I began falling asleep in my car. In between dozing, I scrolled through my phone looking for the name of someone I could call for help, someone who wouldn't judge me. I decided on my ex-boyfriend, Terry, whom I dated and lived with in Phoenix back in 1998 and 1999 before I picked up and moved to Los Angeles without a word. Terry moved to LA just 2 years later, and we kept in touch sporadically over the past 11 years. He was always very supportive of me and had always been there during my roughest times. We hadn't spoken in a couple years, but I knew he wouldn't turn me away. And he didn't. There was just over a week before I could expect my residual checks in the mail, and Terry said he'd let us crash on the sofa bed in his one-bedroom apartment while I waited. He worked long hours from evening into the early mornings. He slept a good portion of the day and had weekends off. Naeem and I wouldn't really be in his way, and I took to the cooking and cleaning to show my gratitude. Terry had a girlfriend, and even though he and I dated back in the late 90s, we'd never looked at each other in that way again. I was safe with Terry. I'd known him for so long, and we had gone through so much together. There was a real history there. He'd known me since before I was anybody, and he'd known Naeem since he was just 1 year old. Terry was always a genuine friend, and I was relieved to be able to stay with him for the coming week. But about 4 days later, after spending the weekend with his girlfriend, Terry sent me a text message that read, "You and Naeem have to be out tomorrow. I have a friend coming to stay with me." My mouth flew open and my heart dropped. I knew what happened. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. Terry must have told his girlfriend I was staying with him, and, intimidated, she demanded I leave. I replied back, "Okay." There was nothing I could say or do. I was at the mercy of others, and I was the only one who put me there. "You guys can stay today and part of tomorrow, but I'm going to need you to be gone by the time I get home from work," Terry continued. "Okay," I responded. And with that, Naeem and I packed up and left immediately. I didn't see the point in prolonging the experience, nor did I see the point in ever speaking to Terry again. Our long-standing friendship was instantly over, and I hoped that for him, it was worth it. I had just enough money for a day at the hotel, and so that's where we were headed. I was still doing my best to not ask Bruce for help, knowing he would only use the opportunity to take advantage of me. So Naeem and I checked back into the extended stay hotel, and I began making phone calls. I called Deneen and asked her to pay for 1 day at the hotel. I called one of my younger sisters and asked the same. They both called the hotel and gave their credit card numbers, making it possible for me to stay there until the checks arrived. I called the UPS store, where my mailbox was housed, every day for several days, asking if my checks were there. For 3 days, the answer was no. But on October 4th, 2012, the answer was yes, and I couldn't drive into the city fast enough. We were saved. Armed with around $11,000, I was ready to start my life over and fast, but I soon found out it wouldn't be that easy. There were backed-up bills that needed to be paid and dings on my credit that needed to be rectified before I could move into another apartment. I applied at several places but was denied over and over again. My living situation remained uncertain, so I paid for an extra month of living at the hotel while trying to find a new place and get a handle on the debt that trailed me since my relationship with Aaron. Even though I was finished with him, I still couldn't escape him. During the first few weeks of October, I continued to fight for my life and livelihood while living in a tiny hotel room with my son. I also continued to see Taj, who moved out of his place and in with a friend just minutes from the hotel. I tried to write, I did, but nothing happened. Maybe a line or two, maybe a paragraph and a half, but nothing more. Everything I wrote was trash and devoid of feeling or meaning. My new representation helped me formulate a book proposal about something I barely cared about and sent it off to publishers. It was only met with more denial. Everywhere I looked, I was being turned down. I was working as hard as I could to make things better. I took comfort that, as hard as things were, At least I didn't have to rely on Bruce for the time being. Still, I was running out of money, and with my rental applications continuing to be denied, I wondered when I would be saved. I wondered how much worse things would get. It didn't take long to find out. On the morning of October 26th, I awoke with a start. I turned off my phone's ringer before going to bed early the night before, but I jumped out of bed that morning feeling frantic, as if there was something wrong. I scrambled around the room looking for the phone, feeling a sense of urgency. I couldn't remember where I put it. I searched high and low, under the pillows, in the bathroom, on the dresser, only to find it under the bed. Turning on the phone, I saw I missed 14 calls and twice as many text messages. The missed calls were from friends of mine, as well as members of Wayne's crew. My hands began to shake as it became evident something was terribly wrong. I checked the first text message of the bunch. It read, "Wayne is in the hospital." I'm sure the message contained other words, but I wasn't about to waste time reading them. I called Wayne. No answer. I called one member of his crew, then another. No answer, no answer. I called my friend Chris while flinging open my laptop to try to find out what was happening. I was scared. I was shaking and tears weren't far behind. Chris answered, "Yo." "What happened?" I asked while searching the internet. "Wayne had a seizure or something on a plane." As he talked, I started reading the news online, and I couldn't hear him anymore. I disconnected the call without saying goodbye and started texting Wayne. "Baby, I'm scared. Please let me know you're all right." I sent the text and waited. And waited. Fuck. Fuck. Fuck, I paced around my room, drinking beers for breakfast, worried about my love. I thought about the fights we had in the past and how silly they all seemed in that moment, when I didn't know how sick Wayne was or if he was